I was at school with Clifford Hulme. He must be the most famous product of an establishment not given to turning out celebrities, or even fitting its sons so much in the way of material success. Hulme managed it on both counts. The wealth, through a business acumen none of us knew he possessed, and the fame, through a taste for high living, and a second wife who had taken off most of her clothes in a couple of minor films. We were a wartime intake, most of us scholarship boys from working-class and lower-middle-class homes, with just a few fee-paying pupils amongst us, of whom Hulme was one. I can't remember what Hulme's father did. He wasn't a manual worker like the fathers of most of us, but neither was he very well off, or he would surely have sent his son to one of the two or three snobbier schools in the district, which had better reputations and a bigger share of scholarships to Oxford and Cambridge. Scholastically, Hulme was a plodding middleweight. Personally, he wasn't widely liked. He displayed a curious tactlessness in his relationships, which irritated some to the point of cursing him, and there were instances of reckless behaviour which endangered not only himself but others. Yet he wasn't considered a brave lad. I can't, for instance, recall his ever fighting a boy his own size. But it was not unknown for him to bully someone smaller in a manner not so much viciously brutal as foolishly gleeful.
"You don't know your own strength, you be a duff beggar."
Well, he found out. And some of us had already found his soft centre. Our headmaster was Dr. Heathcote Jeffreys, a fiery little jumping cracker of a man, whose voice, when he was enraged, and he often was, could be heard halfway through the long corridors of the school. A stern disciplinarian and remorseless pursuer of malefactors, he gave weekly addresses in assembly, remonstrating with us about our patriotic duty, which was to refrain from sabotaging the war effort by slacking, smoking, declining to disturb the brilliantine perfection of our hair by wearing the school cap, and chatting up the girls from a nearby high school at the bus stop. Jeffreys had four sons. One had studied law, another medicine, there was one in the church, and one still at Cambridge. We never knew his real opinion of us. It was usually expressed in tones of blistering contempt, but we were not the stuff such achievement is made of, though we did eventually manage a parson and a handful of schoolteachers on top of the foundations of clerks and mechanics. And, of course, Hulme. I realise now the foreboding that must have gripped the minds of our elders on so many occasions during those first years of the war. But to us it was all rather remote. Whatever fears possessed our grown-ups, either they hid them well or we discounted them. To us, young and adaptable, conditions on the home front rapidly became those of normal life. Food rationing gave some of us a better diet than our parents' choice and limited means would have obtained in an open market. The blacked-out nights cloaked our after-school activities, so we must often have been bored. And in this boredom we sought and found the excitement of petty crime. But we were never apprehended by anyone vengeful enough to make an example of us, and the taint didn't spread over into adult life, at least so far as I know. One or two of those adolescent rogues standing where Hulme is would tempt me to hindsight, and the smug satisfaction of having seen it coming all those years ago. But Hulme was not in our gang. So it was the years of peacetime childhood which became the cloistered fantasy to be left behind, and these abnormal years through which we grew the real world. A corps of staff too old for military service held the fort among the comings and goings of men conscripted and released. There'd been a fire-watching duty since early 1940, a master and three senior boys sleeping in school every night, the master in the staff room, the lads on camp beds in an attic in the old building. They were supposed to patrol the grounds during an air raid and tackle any fires with stirrup pumps until help arrived. The duty was voluntary, but most of us did it for the novelty of sleeping away from home, and being in school but outside the discipline of the timetable. We read and yarned, played cards, had a dartboard until too many wild shots pitted the door with holes and it was taken away from us. Some of us smoked too, always with an ear cocked for footsteps on the stairs, and a paper ready to waft the incriminating fog out of the window. It was an adventure, and our activities, though some in violation of school rules, were innocent enough. Until I did a duty with Eddie Duncalf. I became aware in the early hours of the morning that Eddie wasn't in the room. He was absent for some time. Next day I asked him where he'd been. He grinned. It turned out, and I was not the only one who knew about it, that Eddie had somehow obtained keys which gave him access to the pantry in the kitchen and the store cupboards there. From them, he was helping himself to small amounts of the foodstuffs used in making school meals. Butter, sugar, cheese, tinned meat. Anything, in fact, which was scarce or rationed. I went with him once, but creeping along those dark corridors in the night, expecting at every corner to bump into the master in charge, was too much for my nerves. He made his last raid on a night when Hubie was sharing the duty with us. As Eddie crept from the room and down the stairs, Hubie spoke across the distance between our beds.
"He's a fool."
"What?" I said.
"Don't cough. He'll get nabbed one of these times."
"What do you mean?"
"Don't make out you don't know."
I snored gently into the darkness. But Hubie was to be proved right. Or partly so, for although Eddie wasn't caught in the act, the outcome was the same. The cook had apparently known for some time that pilfering was taking place. This particular week she'd taken an extra careful inventory, and when Eddie overreached himself and stole more than usual, she was able to pinpoint the losses with accuracy. There was an inquiry among the kitchen staff. No culprit could be found there. And then a cleaner remembered seeing currants and raisins on the floor of the fire-watching room. Heathcote Jeffreys questioned the masters first, and then summoned to his study all the lads on that week's fire-watching roster. We lined up in an arc across the front of his desk, jostling shoulder to shoulder in the confined space. Jeffreys, at the window, waited till we'd settled, before spinning round and reaching for a list of names. He checked us off against this without speaking, then took his stance at one end of the mantelshelf.
"There's been some stealing from the pantry."
His gaze raked across the line of faces.
"The culprit is someone who's been on fire-watching duty this week."
No one spoke. Jeffreys must already have selected the likelier suspects, for there were among us some members of SWAT's corner who would no more have robbed the pantry than smoke a cigarette or fail to do their homework diligently. Tolson, Lindsay and Carter did duty together and were standing at one end of the line. Jeffreys began with them.
"Did you steal from the pantry?"
"No, sir."
"Did you steal from the pantry?"
"No, sir."
"Carter, did you steal from the pantry?"
"No, sir."
"Did you steal from the pantry?"
"Oh, no, sir."
This was Billy Morrison, a good lad, who knew about Eddie but would never have dreamed of giving him away. Jeffreys paused here and changed his tactics.
"Do any of you boys know who did steal from the pantry?"
This is one of Jeffreys' least likable features, his inviting you to shop someone else. Morrison spoke for all of us.
"No, sir."
I thought afterwards that it was a trick of the light, but I wanted to believe that his lip did visibly curl, and that Jeffreys noticed it. Jeffreys returned to the direct question.
"Did you steal from the pantry?"
"No, sir."
"No, sir."
"No, sir."
"Eddie?"
"No, sir."
"Me?"
"No, sir."
A stonewall defence. He couldn't break it. He'd come to Hubie, who was last in line.
"Did you steal from the pantry, Hubie?"
"No, sir."
We were through. But Jeffreys, stuck with all those monosyllabic denials, let his gaze linger on Hubie for another couple of seconds. And Hubie, unable to make do with that simple and unbreakable no, rushed in and sank the boat.
"I was in the room, sir."
Jeffreys pounced.
"Which room?"
"The fire-watching room."
"How do you know?"
"Don't know what it means, sir."
"How do you know you were in the fire-watching room?"
"I was, sir."
"You mean it couldn't have been you who broke into the pantry because you were in the fire-watching room at the time?"
"Yes, sir. No, sir.
"So if you didn't do it, it must have been someone who was on duty with you, eh?"
"No, sir."
"But you've just told me that it happened while you were on duty, but it wasn't you because you were in the fire-watching room."
"No, sir."
"So you weren't in the fire-watching room?"
I was, sir."
"At the time the pantry was being burgled."
It was no longer a question but a statement. Hubie floundered, he went red, his mouth trembled. He was lost.
"Yes, sir."
Duncalf came back to the form room alone 20 minutes later, beaten and angry, and with a threat of expulsion hanging over him, which, as it happened, was never carried out.
"You absolute blithering idiot, Hubie! If you aren't the most useless slob I've ever met!"
But he wasn't, as he was not many years in showing. It was working for the press that kept me in touch with Hubie's early fortunes and made me aware of him again when he really started to rise into the big time. I ran into him now and then before I moved to a provincial evening paper from the local weekly. He was clerking for an encore, marking time before he went off to do his national service. When he came back, he began to do small deals in scrap metal, and before long he'd branched out into surplus war materials. He made quite a bit of money, married a girl from the town, and moved into a new, detached, four-bedroomed house. Then I lost sight of him, until, supping on a national daily in Fleet Street, I began to see news powers about him, and when his first wife divorced him, and he married a girl 15 years younger than himself, the occasional photograph. By this time he was going up fast. Everything he touched seemed to prosper. His interests were widespread. Mail order, unit furniture, domestic appliances. I don't know what quality he discovered in himself and nourished so successfully that he became a millionaire before he was 40, because, frankly, I don't understand that kind of talent. It was the business editor who ran through the list of Hubie's interests for me, and who later, aware now that I'd known him once, warned me of the whispers which preceded the investigation into his affairs and the eventual bringing of charges. Issuing a fraudulent prospectus is one of them, and facing the music with him are a couple of fellow directors and a secretary of one of his companies. I don't know, of course, whether Hubie's guilty or not, whether his substance is solid or just a bubble blown by him or his colleagues, but a number of offences do seem to have been committed, and it looks as though the real issue is who is going to carry the can. What I'm wondering now is whether Mr. Heathcote Jeffreys, Jr., QC, who is to open for the Crown, is as good an interrogator as his father was, seizing on any tiny slip to force, with the ruthless sharpness of his mind and the overwhelming power of his personality, a breach in a solid wall of falsehood. Does he know that Hubie was one of his father's pupils years ago? Probably not, and it doesn't matter. The old man had no doubt forgotten the incident long before he died. But I know what I'd be feeling if I were in the dock with Hubie tomorrow, aware that the penalty this time will not be 6 of the best, but more like a year or two inside and a paralyzing fine, and waiting. Oh, the sweaty palms, stomach-fluttering waiting for Hubie to be offered and succumb to that fatal temptation to enlarge.